From SDPB Radio, I'm Josh Heyer, filling in for Lori Walsh. And welcome to the In the Moment podcast. In this week's news, we'll hear from SDPB's Lee Strubinger on Hand County potentially seeing another animal feedlot operation that may complicate things there. Tuesday marked the last day of the Nest Predator Bounty Program, and we'll hear reactions from SDPB's Michael Zimney. Political junkies talked the state's top political headlines. Lori Walsh talked with Lori Gill, Secretary of the South Dakota Department of Social Services, and could gratitude decrease stress? But first, the National Farmers Organization said the country's farmers deserve better when it comes to the 2020 proposed renewable fuel standards. Lori sat down with Scott Stahl, Vice President of South Dakota Corn Growers, and Rob Walther. He is the Vice President of Federal Policy at POET. Let's take a listen.
So for some of our urban listeners, and we have a statewide audience, rural and urban, but for some people who aren't making the connection between renewable energy and corn, help people understand what exactly that connection is in South Dakota.
Yeah, South Dakota has really benefited from the renewable fuel industry, and speaking to the RFS, what it's allowed is for producers in South Dakota here, instead of taking our grain and shipping it overseas, we're able to use it right in our local communities. As you know, South Dakota, especially the eastern half of the state, is peppered with ethanol plants that have allowed for local demand and use of our corn. And as you know, that generic use of the corn allows for, you know, a better market for the corn that I produce right here in South Dakota. It allows for fuel that's cleaner to burn in our engines. It's better for our air here in South Dakota. And another neat thing about the industry and something we utilize on our farm is the byproduct, which is the distiller's grain, is something we're able to feed our cattle. So there's a lot of synergy that's been created through the ethanol industry. And it's really almost kind of a renaissance of younger producers. I'm 33 years old. There's a lot of producers my age that were able to get into farming, and because of the margin and the opportunity that was created by the ethanol industry. So it's exciting to be a part of, and it's very disheartening to see the EPA come through with some of these waivers that have really reduced the demand for ethanol and really reduced the demand for the product on my farm right here in South Dakota.
Let's talk about those waivers, and for that, let's bring Rob Walther. He's Vice President of Federal Policy at POET into the conversation. Hey, Rob, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Lori. Thanks for having me.
Tell us what's happening in Washington right now. What sort of policy challenges are impacting the state?
Yeah, it's a pretty tough time here in Washington. As you are aware, and as Scott mentioned, we are seeing the renewable fuel standard and biofuel policy in general under constant attack from the oil industry. And unfortunately, the EPA and this administration seem to be a little bit susceptible to the arguments that they're making. We have seen certainly some successes. We had the RVP, or reed vapor pressure, rule passed, which allows E15, so that higher blend of ethanol, to be sold year-round. But at the end of the day, there seems to be confusion that RVP, E15, equals a win. At the end of the day, what we were promised was the opportunity to blend more biofuels into the gasoline mix. And some of the policies that are being taken up by EPA are limiting growth and limiting the ability of us to blend ethanol and fight for a free marketplace in the United States.
Tell us, Rob, about the waivers. You say that this administration has issued unprecedented number of waivers. Give us a little history about that and tell us what's going on right now.
Sure. So real briefly, the renewable fuel standard was a mechanism that allows ethanol to enter into the marketplace. These waivers were the waiver system was essentially created so that small refineries that are disproportionately harmed by the RFS, and I want to really emphasize that word, disproportionately harmed, would be waived out of the program. So they wouldn't have to comply with the renewable fuel standard. Unfortunately, this administration, and it started under Scott Pruitt, who is no friend of biofuels or the Midwest, started giving out these waivers to any refiner who applied. And so what that essentially did was it said, we are going to cut the required gallons going out under the RFS from what had been the full statutory requirement down to well below what oil companies would otherwise use anyway, irrespective of the law. And unfortunately, on Friday, we got word that it looks like they're going to move forward with even more of these waivers. So we're going to see another 1.4 billion gallons of ethanol cut out of the fuel mix. So this is real harm. And all those headwinds Scott was mentioning facing the farmers, this is just another big gust that, you know, at some point could topple the whole thing over.
Scott, it's kind of the perfect storm with that weather we talked about with the pinch on biofuel and the ethanol industry, and then you add that international trade war. It's got to be a lot going on and a lot of pressure for a young family on the farm right now.
Yeah, you said it exactly right, Lori. Really unprecedented times, and you can talk to any ag economist across the nation. The reason ag did have a strong foothold the last 10 years and we saw some momentum building was because of, you know, strong trade abroad and also the RFS. And we've really seen those two things gutted under this administration. And it's been something that's tough to work through as a young producer. Like you said, as a younger producer, you don't have probably the financial wherewithal and the equity to weather through some of these tough times. But USDA, I mean, it's pretty well known. We're in the sixth consecutive year of declining income for farmers. Looking at our income nationwide, about half of what it was 6 years ago. So we know that at the end of the day, producers in the United States, South Dakota in particular, we produce the cleanest, cheapest fuel anywhere. And octane, you look at it however you want to, we just need access to that marketplace. And that's something the RFS allowed us to do. And Rob mentioned, just seeing that gutted is really, it's really a stake in the back right now. Because right now we need a win. We're looking for a win as producers. And E15, we are thankful to see that. But we need to build some momentum and help create demand. Because the demand destruction at the end of the day, it hurts farmers, but it also hurts everybody that relies upon the farming and ag industry in South Dakota. You know, South Dakota, number one industry in South Dakota is agriculture. So it's all part of the trickle-down effect. It's hard to see, and we're thankful for people like Rob fighting for farmers across this state.
And Rob, you mentioned exemptions or waivers for small refineries. Well, some of the waivers are being issued to refineries with names like ExxonMobil and Chevron. Those don't sound very small to me.
No, I would love some of their economic hardship on our balance sheets right about now. I mean, it is unconscionable that ExxonMobil, the highest capitalized company in the world, is able to take from the pockets of farmers with these refinery waivers. At the end of the day, Scott nailed it. You know, we are talking about a product, E15, that is less expensive when you pull up to the pump. Every single station that is carrying E15 in this country has seen significant uptake of the product because people don't want to pay so much for gasoline. And if you look at ethanol compared to gasoline, we are still less expensive today than oil. And oil is really not very expensive right now. It's only about $50 a barrel. So we can still beat them at a price point. That's why the oil companies are so scared of us. They've never had true competition in the marketplace. The RFS, and this goes to Scott's point and the point I made earlier, the RFS was about allowing us access. But by giving out these refinery waivers, we can't get access. And so that is why this fight is so hot and heavy in D.C. right now, and why you're probably going to hear about this for many months, if not years, to come.
And Scott, I'm going to ask you this question, but Rob, maybe it's a question you want to weigh into here in just a minute. But Scott, we've been talking on this show a lot about, CRP acres and, no-till agriculture and buffer strips and sustainable and regenerative ag has been a big topic of conversation lately. But when we talk about ethanol, we're also talking about renewable energy and greenhouse gas emissions. This is a really complex picture for the farmer trying to figure out how to stay in business and do the right thing for the planet. Part of that picture for you is clearly ethanol.
Yeah, absolutely, Lori. And, you know, we're proud to be a high-octane, low-carbon fuel. And part of what's allowed that to happen is technology. You know, we are growing more crops, or we're taking, you know, we're growing more commodities on the same amount of acres every year. You know, at first when the RFS came out, there were some concerns about land use changes, those sorts of things, and studies have proven that not true. I mean, we're very proud to be sustainable from an environmental standpoint, but economic sustainability is a real concern with some of the changes that have occurred here, especially in the last 12 months. You know, we are a low carbon fuel, and every year we're able to take something and renew, grow it again. You know, if you take a bucket of coal out of the ground or a gallon of oil out of the ground, that's it for our lifetime. And I'm proud to say that I do something every year that has become more efficient, and technology is a part of that, and also better and more sustainable ag practices, which these younger generation of producers are excited about. So it's scary to think that we're losing some of those producers. I mean, you see land sales all the time, you know, published, but we know that at the end of the day, ethanol is a huge benefit, and we hate to lose that market here in South Dakota.
Hand County could see another animal feedlot operation. The East River County is already home to half a dozen concentrated livestock operations. This week, state officials approved an incentive package that could help land the new hog farm, but the move could also complicate the county commissioner's approval. SDPB's Lee Strubinger has the report.
Pat Moriarty lives just south of Miller and a few miles away from the site of a proposed concentrated feedlot operation. The project calls for about 9,000 hogs. Moriarty worries about potential effect to the environment, like nearby wetlands managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
I listen to the birds in the morning, and that's going to be impacted. There are going to be people going in and out of there all the time. It's probably going to change where the birds end up.
After a recent Hand County Zoning Board meeting, Moriarty says odor from the feedlot will degrade her quality of life.
I won't be able to put my clothes on the line anymore. I'm not going to be able to sit out in the yard. We don't have air conditioning, so we rely on nature's air conditioning. I'm not going to be able to use that.
Moriarty's husband, Bob, has a chronic lung condition. Pat says she suffers from an irregular heartbeat. She worries about potential health effects. A DeSmet-based company, Ratio LLC, is behind the new venture. Kirk Augenbaugh will run the operation. They expect to employ nearly 20 people. They're working with the Minnesota-based Pipestone System to build the breeding farm. Officials from both companies declined to comment for this story. The state incentive program will give back taxes collected on the project to the county. This project is one of the first in the state since the program was announced. Joe Fiala is a community development director for the Office of Economic Development. He says to qualify for a state incentive, a project must meet two conditions.
It has to add new livestock to the state. And then secondly, it needs to require a newly issued conditional use permit.
The new hog feedlot proposed for Hand County is big enough that it would require a conditional use permit. That threshold is determined by either the state or county. The livestock development program combines two existing state programs into one, the Reinvestment Payment Program and the South Dakota Jobs Program. Fiala says the state legislature created those programs in 2013, and they've been primarily used for manufacturing and wind energy. Hand County residents opposed to the new hog farm say they've seen a letter from the state to project developers. It says the county could see nearly $500,000 from the project. Residents also say without the incentives, the company might not get county approval.
It's one that doesn't smell right to me.
That's Mitch Peterson, an attorney from Sioux Falls representing the concerned landowners in Hand County. Peterson sees the livestock development program as the state attempting to sway county-level decisions.
And the counties are supposed to really be making the decisions on their own about what goes on in the county from a regulatory standpoint. So when you have such a large financial incentive from the state, I think that doesn't fit well, in my view, with state and local control.
During the recent Hand County zoning meeting, some residents compared the state incentive to a bribe. J.D. Wangsness is chair of the Hand County Commission. He says the livestock development program is not a bribe, but it's something new the commission must consider.
So it is a pretty big incentive from the state. So it makes these kind of proceedings more difficult because it's a pretty big elephant standing there in the room. So.
In fact, the potential of a local windfall from a new hog operation brought out many local residents opposed to the project to recent zoning meetings. Wangsness says the possibility of almost $500,000 in incentive payments won't sway his decision.
I mean, we know it's out there, but no, I'm not. If this thing doesn't fit, I'm not going to vote for it just because that letter's there. So, and the rest of the board's going to feel the same way about it.
Wangsness says their vote will likely come at a September meeting. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strupinger in Miller, South Dakota.
Tuesday marked the last day of the state's Nest Predator Bounty Program. The program, which aimed to increase pheasant numbers by reducing the number of predators that prey on ground nesting birds, as well as promote interest in trapping, was scheduled to last until August 31st, or until trappers turned in 50,000 tails to South Dakota Game Fish and Parks in exchange for a $10 bounty per tail. Reactions to the program were varied, even within the trapping community. SDPB's Michael Zimney reports.
Earlier this year, South Dakota Game Fish and Parks kicked off the Nest Predator Bounty Program promised by Governor Kristi Noem. Program goals included increasing the number of ringneck pheasants available for hunter harvest, as well as increased participation in trapping. In pursuit of these goals, the program will distribute 16,000 live traps and has already paid a $10 bounty on 50,000 tails collected from raccoons, opossums, badgers, red foxes, and striped skunks. The number of tails collected could be tracked in real time online. A social media campaign was launched in tandem with the program, utilizing the hashtag Second Century Trapper. The Instagram posts and the number of free traps requested demonstrated enthusiasm for the program, though unsurprisingly, the program was not wholly uncontroversial. However, responses to the program don't break down neatly into a predictable trappers versus animal rights activist dynamic. Kim Potter is the owner of Potter Fur Company in Bridgewater, South Dakota. He says the bounty program as instituted may have been subject to abuse.
Being in the business as a fur buyer, I mean, just to me, it's a resource that's taken away. Ask anybody in South Dakota, when you're driving down the road, how many tailless coon or opossum or skunk did you see on the road this summer? I mean, that wasn't supposed to be part of the program, but I think there was so much room for fraud in there that they're just throwing a lot of that money away.
He says that tails have even disappeared from carcasses in a rendering pile outside his business. Spencer Newharth is the hunting editor for Meat Eater, the popular Netflix show, podcast, and website about hunting and fishing. He grew up trapping in southeastern South Dakota. He echoes some of Potter's concerns.
My biggest issue with the whole thing has been the allocation of that $500,000. I just don't think that is money well spent.
Newharth says he's worried that the program lacked controls for preventing fraud.
There have been concerns since the state announced that they were going to do this bounty program that there might be some dishonesty involved. People were fearful that this might be abused, as it has happened in other states. I think one example is Utah, when they did a coyote bounty program. They quickly found out that people were bringing in coyotes from other states. And what has happened with South Dakota's bounty program is that a lot of people initially were reporting tails being cut off of roadkill animals. You know, I've been told by a sheriff in the state that every, like, varmint roadkill they come across has the tail cut off.
Kim Potter says targeted trapping could be an effective tool in halting the decline in pheasant numbers, citing the efforts of a conservation group called Delta Waterfowl.
Delta Waterfowl does a thing where they do that, and they have great success rates, but they're picking out like a section of ground and specifically targeting that area. But this is just a helter-skelter, you know, all over the state hitting this kind of a thing.
Potter also raises pheasants.
As a guy that raises pheasants, they'd be better off going to producers and saying, hey, here are these 10 public areas. You go, Kim, go release 50 birds in here each week.
He agrees with the program's stated goal of getting young people involved in trapping.
It's a good thing. I grew up with my dad trapping as a kid, and you know, it was those times that through junior high and high school where we could have easily gone in a couple different ways, but no matter what issues we had that bond of trapping, you know, no matter what was going on in our other lives when we were out on the trap line, man, we were buds. I'm a proponent totally of getting young people involved, and if this helps that's fantastic.
Some people prefer alternate activities for getting children outdoors. Nancy Hilding of the Prairie Audubon Society says that the state needs to make changes to its trapping regulations before trying to get more kids involved.
The way they're justifying it, the way they're going to bed at night, is to say we're doing this to engage the children in trapping. And so then you get back to the South Dakota's trapping regulations and laws. The Born Free USA gives South Dakota an F on our trapping regulations. We have lots of problems with our trapping regulations. So we are teaching, in essence, sadism to children. Because before we started handing out free traps, we didn't clean up the trapping regulations and reform them.
The Prairie Audubon Society has proposed several rules changes, including requiring trappers to check traps more often. Spencer Newharth supports getting young people involved in outdoor sporting activities.
I'm okay with the state promoting certain activities and using money to do so. I think like a great success story is the outdoor campus in Sioux Falls. Every week, they're offering classes that are specific to youth, specific to women, just as an effort to get more people involved. I think with the goal being to get kids involved in trapping, that offering $10 a tail didn't get like any new participants involved. Trapping has a fairly high barrier to entry as far as the knowledge to do so and the equipment and having the land. On the flip side, something like fishing has a way lower barrier to entry. That's something that is familiar to people, even if they aren't hardcore fishermen or hardcore outdoorsmen. That's something you can pick up and do. Trapping is very different than that.
Michael Morlock is South Dakota State Coordinator for Pheasants Forever. He said via email that the program did spark interest in trapping, writing that the Nest Predator program was very effective at recruiting and reactivating men, women, and youth into the lost art of trapping, which had seen a large decline in participation over recent years. Getting more South Dakota residents onto our diverse landscapes will ultimately help recruit more conservationists, hunters, and license buyers who can support the state's natural resources efforts in the long term. Kim Potter says time will tell if the program succeeded in renewing interest in trapping.
Well, you'll be able to see that if you're going to have an increase in per bear licenses, and that's to be determined.
Game Fish and Parks officials are not saying if the program will continue next year. From Rapid City, this is Michael Zimney.
Dakota political junkies Jonathan Ellis from the Sioux Falls Argus Leader and Mike Card from the University of South Dakota joined us for a look at the state's top political headlines.
So I remember during the campaign him really talking about this issue and being affected by it. Now he's in Washington. And one of the things I asked him was, well, you know, fast forward, pretend you're in Washington right now, what would you do? And so one of these signatories of this letter is Neil Tapio, former state lawmaker. He ran against Congressman Dusty Johnson in the primary. At that time, he lost. Kind of throwing around on Facebook some criticisms of the congressman and toying with or creating some speculation that he might run against Johnson in a primary. So, Mike Card, let's talk a little bit about how an issue like this can also turn political in the sense that it shakes out not only criticism, but candidates.
Well, I first of all would argue that this isn't going to turn political. This is a political issue. It may not represent all political parties, but it's certainly an urban-rural issue and a young old issue as well. But certainly if you're running for office and you can create a distinction between an incumbent candidate and argue that they're not representing the wishes of the public, I think that's what's being asserted by Mr. Tapio, then that's an issue that you might be able to get more voters.
And I want to go back to this idea of Neil Tapio sort of criticizing Congressman Johnson for not standing with Trump often enough. But this letter about the red flag legislation is a letter to President Trump and Senator Thune and, obviously Senator or former Senator Tapio doesn't agree, state senator doesn't agree with President Trump on this because it's the president who's been talking in his speech after these recent shootings, talked about red flag legislation. He seemed like he was open to it at the very least. Mike, your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the president recognizes that there is a growing opposition to, as if it weren't obvious, mass shootings, and something has to be done. And I think part of the problem is we don't have any research that would indicate what's to be done. Getting back to your specific question, I think the president is stating the obvious. We've got to do something, so let's start with something that might be palatable to a group of senators so that it might pass through the Senate. I think John is right. It'll go through the House, if not more stringent measures involving more gun control and limits on registration and open carry and things of that nature. I don't think many of those are going to get through the House. Majority Leader McConnell controls what gets on the agenda, and he's noted that he's not going to put anything up for a vote that he doesn't think is going to pass. Those are his words. So the fight in the Republican Party is in the Senate for what's palatable enough. What can we do to it to deal with some of the issues that we're dealing with mass violence?
So, Jonathan, how is it okay for, you hear Dusty Johnson saying, I'm not a rubber stamp here just to say whatever the president, I'm going to think for myself, I'm going to represent the people of South Dakota. Is that sort of a hollow argument from Neil Tapio then when he himself is signing a letter saying, I'm not with the president on this?
Well, not when it comes to ardent gun supporters. I think at least that carving out that area, I think Neil would be safe because, again, certain segment of the Republican primary, I mean, they are very passionate about firearm ownership. And so I don't think that Neil would alienate those voters. It'd be kind of interesting to see if there was some legislation that red flag, as an example, if it did pass the Senate and there's something that would, ended up in the House, I would be kind of curious to see how Dusty Johnson would vote. You know, a lot of that would depend at the end of the day probably on what the NRA's stance would be.
Right.
If the NRA were to concede that, maybe this is, not broad enough legislation that would imperil, ownership, and they supported it, then I think that would give a lot of political cover for other Republicans to support something.
I like that political cover. Let's close with an update on the surveillance balloons. And Jonathan, tell me how to pronounce Lisa, your colleague at the Argus Leader, her last name.
Lisa Kapsky.
Kapsky, yeah. So she has a piece that I'm looking at argusleader.com. You can find it with a few updates on the surveillance balloons that were launched from South Dakota. And we've talked about it before on this program, but the last thing we left it was, there needs to be some vigilance about what's happening. Jonathan, what was happening?
Well, officially, they were
right?
Just kind of, testing these things out and taking some test flights and flying around, taking some still pictures or whatever. And certainly they've denied that they were conducting any kind of surveillance. Which, apparently I didn't really know this, that would be illegal under federal law for these balloons to be hanging out up there and conducting surveillance. But very clearly they could be used if they needed to be in that sense. And if it's the Pentagon, they're probably testing these balloons for use and certainly other theaters of operation. But, you're a civil libertarian type, having these balloons floating around at 50,000 feet with the ability to, hone in in great detail to follow cars around or, take pictures. I mean, if you're somebody who cares about living in a free society, then that's certainly something you're going to be a little concerned about.
childcare, economic assistance programs, and Medicaid are just a few of the examples of what the South Dakota Department of Social Services focuses on. But what programs consume the most dollars? What are the main reasons people find themselves in need of assistance? And what programs could use more help? Lori Gill is the Secretary of the South Dakota Department of Social Services and joined Lori Walsh to answer these questions.
All right, let's start with a big picture look. Tell us, what do you think it's important for South Dakotan citizens, for people who live here listening to this program and a statewide audience? What should they understand about South Dakota social services specifically?
Yeah, well, this is a great opportunity for me to talk about an agency that administers several programs to assist low-income individuals, children, and families. And I think, the main focus is that the programs that we have help people and families with their food, their home heating costs, medical assistance, and they help with basic needs. But the Department of Social Services in general, the functions are to keep the children safe and to very much provide supports to strengthen and support individuals and families. So that everything revolves around that general umbrella.
So how often does it shift? Say, for example, when we see farmers in dire straits this year, with flooding and an ongoing economic pressure, then do you sort of see, resources shifting? Do we have to start new programs? Do you have those programs in place to kind of meet those emotional, and health support needs for farmers and ranchers already?
Yeah, that's a great question. And of course, the programs that we do have that I've already mentioned are impacted by the state of the economy. People most often seek assistance when there's been a life event that strains their economic circumstances. So yes, the farm economy, the ag economy would have an impact, and just the general nationwide economy would all weigh in on how people are experiencing their life and the stressors that they're facing. The types of life changes that cause somebody to come and look for services would be the loss of a job, separation from a spouse or other support source. It's usually when there has been a life event that really has changed their circumstances. And we provide the supports here. We try to ensure that people have what they need to have their families stay together and be safe, but yet be productive in the society. So we've got a lot of different programs that can help, but we do see changes in numbers when there are changes in the economic situation in South Dakota.
Give us a snapshot of South Dakota's social services needs. Where are some of those resources going?
Yeah, well, we have several programs that are in existence for different reasons. The programs that we have are income-based. And so an example would be the Supplemental Nutrition and Assistance Program. That is a program that provides food assistance to low-income South Dakotans, and participants have a work requirement unless they meet an exemption. And so that would be food-based. We have another program called TANF, and that would be the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. That helps families with basic needs that have children under the age of 18 who are deprived of parental support. And a large percentage of those families that are receiving that support are situations where the children are being cared for by someone other than their parents, like another family member. So that would be a temporary assistance for that situation. And then there's the Medicaid program and the children's health insurance programs. That provides health coverage, acting as insurance to pay for medically necessary services. And that particular program is there largely serving children. And it also would be there to provide health insurance for individuals that are have disabilities or the elderly. So those are just some examples of some of the programs that we have and where those dollars are going.
Is there, do you see a certain demand in one area or the other? What is, when you, you know, you, every individual story is an individual person, an individual child, a family, a job loss that has its own ripple effects. You also get to see, and I'm sure you never forget that in your role, but you also get to see that data and you get to see that big picture. What does that big picture tell you about what's happening in people's lives right now based on how they're using the services?
Yes. Well, as we've already discussed, the numbers go up and down based on what's going on in the economy, so we can kind of see correlations there. But we do know that the majority of the people that are on our services are there short term. The programs are there to provide a gap filler when a family is in need or an individual is in need, and we try to get them through that time and back. Get their life turned around and back where they aren't in need of our services. When we're looking at the different programs and the number of folks on it, by far our largest program is the Medicaid program, the insurance program. We do have, on an average monthly basis, about almost a little over 38,000 households that receive the SNAP program, and that would be the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. TANF is a lower number, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. That's serving almost 3,000 households on an average basis in a month. So you can see there's the different programs have different criteria. Some of the programs have work requirements, and there's just different federal criteria for each program, depending on what it is and who they're serving. A couple other programs that we have that have been very helpful. One is low-income energy assistance, and that assistance helps with home heating expenses. And in the upper Midwest, that can be very valuable for those that are in need. And for that type of a program, 88% of the cases are for elderly, disabled, and households with children. We also have weatherization programming that enables low-income families to reduce their energy bills by making their homes more energy efficient. And so those are just the kinds of things that are real valuable programs that help people when they really need it.
So you mentioned short-term gap filler. So, and I remember taking a relative of mine down to sign up for services in years past, and really being surprised as we sort of stood in the line, and she was, you know, she was a younger woman, and she saw all these people that had gone to high school with her, and they were having conversations about what was happening in their lives right then. We sat down with the counselor, and there were all these different, you know, pathways for assistance that she didn't know when she walked in the door really existed. And a lot of it, you mentioned, was temporary. So when we talk about in this country sort of pulling yourself up by the bootstraps, and you hear those conversations, how do you sort of process that in your role?
Yes. Well, I think there is a misconception out there across the nation about the types of programs that are provided by social service agencies. But in South Dakota, we do have a general work ethic, and people do want to be productive, and generally they do not want to be dependent on the types of services that we provide. But we do know that there are a lot of factors that affect individuals and families, things that are outside of their control. And it is very important from our perspective that we're providing the supports, especially when children are involved, that we have safe and secure family scenarios, or at least scenarios where basic needs are met. And you're right, the benefits that we provide are temporary, and most people receive the various programming that we have for just a short time. One other thing that we do is we have staff across the state that provide information to help people get the best use of their benefits. So we do a lot of education, and examples of that, even though we are providing the dollars for food through the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, we're providing nutrition and food budgeting education so that people can learn how to take the dollars that they get and make good choices and stretch those dollars to the best of their ability within their means to, for instance, have a food budget that can last for the month, get them to the next time that they get some payment. We give education in the area of energy conservation. If we're coming out and providing the funding that helps with weatherization or energy assistance, we also provide the education about energy conservation, how to make everything last. We talk about money management, and we also have a connection to community resources. So we want to make sure that the people that are on our programs, wherever they're located in the state, have access to the resources in their community that can help them further along. And many times there are things in their community that they're not aware of. And so we see that as another role, to link them up to those resources that might be available.
The relationships we cultivate in our lives are essential to our happiness. But what about our health? Dr. Nathan Dykert's research examines how a person's gratitude, relationships, and support relate to physical and mental health. I had a chance to chat with Dr. Dykert earlier this week about how simply being grateful can reduce one's stress. So Nathan, a lot of your research focuses on this concept of how gratitude plays a role in our mental and physical health. Can you start out by really defining what that means?
Well, in terms of what it means in my research, what I usually look at are these emotional experiences that are elicited by receiving help from other people. And that's usually what I'm talking about when I'm talking about gratitude, is those thoughts and feelings that you have when you receive help from others. And when it comes to social support, it's really those interactions that people have with one another that provide help to them during times of stress. And I like to look at the relationship between the social support people receive and the feelings of gratitude, and how that can help us cope better with stress and help us to feel better emotionally as well as physically.
And in your research, you call gratitude a stress buffer. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Sure. So people who are more grateful tend to have less reactivity to stress in both terms of mental health and also in terms of physical health. So one of the things that we've discovered in some of the research we've done is that when people receive support, if they also have feelings of gratitude, that makes the support better at reducing those negative psychological and physical responses. And so what we think is going on is that people who are grateful may be better able to accept support from other people, because sometimes people will have a reaction to support that I have to pay you back. So if you do something nice for me, I might have that reaction of, or think that I have to pay you back and that I owe you. And when you have those thoughts, that is going to decrease the effectiveness of support in terms of promoting those positive health outcomes. And one of the things that I think is going on is that when people receive support, if they're more grateful, they're less likely to have those thoughts. And so they're more able to accept and be willing to accept support that is being offered from other people.
Right, I gotcha. Right. So we're all a lot happier when we have a lot of friendships and things like that. And a lot of your research talks about those relationships and how they play a role. I want to touch on the types of relationships, the quantity of relationships we have, and the quality of those relationships. Do some of those draw stronger correlations to health and well-being? For example, I saw in your research, a marriage can make a big difference in someone's life versus being single and things like that. I thought that was very interesting. Can you touch on that?
Sure. If my wife is listening, that is absolutely, absolutely true. So there is research that has kind of looked at social support and relationships in more of a numerical sense, so simply looking at how many social connections do you have, and there's other research that has looked at the quality of relationships and the quality of those supportive gestures. And so both tend to support this idea that support is good. So if you have a larger support network, that tends to be predictive of better health outcomes, and quality is certainly something that is important as well. There's been some research looking at receiving support from strangers versus friends. And what you typically see is that individuals who have better quality relationships, or I should say support coming from relationships that are of higher quality, tend to be better at reducing stress. So they both tend to suggest that support is beneficial. When you look at comparing quantity versus quality, which one's the stronger predictor, more often it's the quality that's driving that. And in fact, if you look at some research, just having one person, just having one confidant that you can talk to and trust and is there for you to listen to you and to help you, that tends to be kind of the magic number. But those confidant types of relationships are usually also associated with incredibly high quality, a lot of intimacy. And so you tend to see the quality aspects being important in driving those the benefits of social support.
So you're telling me a one quality relationship can outcompete my 3,000 Facebook friends, huh?
I would go with the one quality relationship every time, yep.
Just quick, what do you think is the biggest takeaway and most important things for South Dakotans to understand regarding this research?
Well, I think one of the things that's important is to understand the importance of having high quality relationships and the importance that they have in regards to our psychological well-being. And so if you have those, obviously make use of those. And that gratitude and other factors as well can actually impact those to kind of make the relationships, the effect of relationships stronger. That would be sort of the take-home message that I would want folks to know about my research.
Education and Healthcare Reporting on SDPB is supported by Regional Health, helping patients and communities live well.
Jerry Steinle's previous role with the Humane Society of the Black Hills was the Resource Development Director, where he held that position for a couple of years. Recently, the Board of Directors appointed him Executive Director. Steinle takes over a society that takes in nearly 5,000 animals annually from as many as 20 counties. SDPB's Chris Loffrey talks to Jerry about adoption, the society, and their needs. Let's listen.
The Humane Society, it's an animal shelter, but we can't do our job, we can't do it effectively without community support. We can't do it without the public. So it's very important to us that not only do we reach out and communicate with the public, and explain our mission and explain our vision and to get that support, but then to also reach out and offer food programs and offer services and training and different things that support our mission in the community.
I'm guessing that's a daily task, correct?
Daily task. Yes, it is. Very busy, and it's just ongoing.
Moving forward, what are your goals or visions, if you will?
Well, expanding the outreach and expanding education, I think, me personally, that's really important. I really want to see that happen. In-house, we've got a trainer, and she's developing curriculum now. We're going to start offering training classes at the Humane Society. So ideally, the big vision is to get her services out to the schools so we can become more of a fixture at different levels like that. I'd like to see a big thing I've talked about for years. I want to see a gazebo in the back. I want to see a place we can have gatherings. We can have schools. We can have education projects right on our grounds, so we have a covered area. That's a big deal. We'd also like to see, at the state level, we want to see some legislation to address cost of care after seizures and different things, to either take care of those animals right up front, or better, get them adopted right away rather than sitting in the facility waiting for a court case to run its course.
Now, adoption is a big step for most. What do you tell people when they walk in your doors and they're coming into the shelter seeking a new pet?
We have a process in place. Anybody coming in to adopt, they meet with an adoption advisor, obviously. They go through paperwork. Adoption isn't just swinging in and picking up an animal. It's a commitment. It's a 10, 15-year commitment. You need to make sure you have the right house. You need to make sure you have the financial resources. You make sure the family's involved. It's not just taking an animal home. What we are trying to accomplish is when that animal goes out into that house, it stays in that home. It becomes a member of that family. They don't take it home for, 3 months or 6 months and then bring it back with the new problems that it has developed.
Do you have resources to treat animals? Let's say they come in and they may be in poor health.
We do. We actually do that a lot. We have a medical staff on site. We do not have a veterinarian, but we have a staff that'll do basic checkups. They'll do some vaccinations. They'll, check for different things. We do manage diets. We manage medications. And then anything we can't handle, we can send out to a veterinarian in town. And we do that a lot. We do it every day. We transport dozens of animals out for treatment. And like I said, it's about humane treatment. So if an animal's in pain or in some kind of distress and it can be addressed reasonably at a veterinarian or in-house, we're going to do it. That's really important to us. Everybody there cares immensely about these animals, and that's always a focus.
You're not affiliated with any other society. You mentioned earlier you solely rely on public funding and donations. Expand on that, if you will, and what can citizens do to help?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. We are not affiliated with, the Humane Society of the United States. Anything that you don't donate to the Humane Society of the Black Hills in Rapid City does not come to us. To help with the Humane Society, obviously you can go to our website, you can stop in. Donations stay at the local level. We take food, we take supplies, cash, obviously, and then volunteers. We have a lot of really great volunteers that come down, and that's also a donation, and that all makes the whole operation work.
Let's expand on the volunteer operations. I'm sure you're seeking them. What are you seeking as far as volunteers are concerned?
We're always seeking volunteers. Typically, the volunteers at the Humane Society, they spend time with dogs and cats. Those are the big things the volunteers do. They come down, they walk them, they help keep those animals, not the cats, obviously, just the dogs.
Right.
I don't want to start that. Sure. But they'll come down and walk those dogs and keep them socialized, because some of those dogs might be there for a month or 2 months or 3 months, and it keeps them happy and it keeps them healthy and it keeps them adoptable. And that's primarily what volunteers do. But we also have volunteers that do events. We have volunteers that help on the grounds and volunteers that help with different projects around the building. They're excellent, excellent people, excellent resource.
That's it for this week. Thank you for bearing with me being the host. Lori will be back soon. Looking for an individual segment from our radio program? You can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org. Just go on the Programs tab, find All Programs, and there you will find the In the Moment segments page. Follow us on Instagram at @sdpbinthemoment and Twitter at @momentsdpb. Have a story idea? Send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. From Lori Walsh, Chris Loffrey, and Steve Zwemke, I'm Josh Heyer. Thanks for listening.